Now the Passover and the festival of the unleavened bread were only 2 days away, and the chief priests and the teachers of the law were scheming to arrest Jesus secretly and kill him. But not during the festival, they said, or the people may riot. While he was in Bethany, reclining on the table in the home of Simon the leper, a woman came with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume, made of pure nard. She broke the jar and poured the perfume on his head. Some of those present were saying indignantly to one another, "Why waste all this perfume? It could have been sold for more than a year's wages, and the money given to the poor." And they rebuked her harshly. "Leave her alone," said Jesus. "Why are you bothering her? She has done a beautiful thing. The poor you will always have with you. You can help them anytime you want, but you will not always have me." So she did what she could. She poured perfume on my body before to prepare for my burial. Truly, I tell you, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her. Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray Jesus to them. They were delighted to hear this and promised to give him money, so he watched for every opportunity to hand him over.
Thank you very much. Thank you for reading. Now, I have to confess that most art passes me by. Its subtle meanings and allusions are a closed book to my eyes, really. But I was once in an art gallery, and I was struck by a picture and the violent contrast between dark and light. I think we have a similar picture, which can come up on the screen. In the front, there was a bright light and a single character illuminated by this light. But as you look and spend a bit more time looking, you see some darker characters hiding off in the background. I was doing some research this last week and found out that it's a style of art called tenebrism, in case you were interested in that kind of thing, where dark and light is set in sharp contrast. And that contrast does two things for us, doesn't it? Firstly, it draws our eyes and it makes the light lighter, but it also makes the dark darker. And that's similar to what Mark does in chapter 14, painting with words. He sets light and dark in contrast. In many ways, it is a terrible chapter, featuring the betrayal of close friends, failure, weakness, sorrow unto death, desertion, wrongful arrest, false accusations, and a gross miscarriage of justice. By the end of a chapter, an innocent man is condemned to death and being beaten in prison, and his best friend is breaking down in tears, having betrayed him. Jesus' close circle of friends will show that they're no better than Israel's leaders, who in fact are already under the judgment of God. But against that dark background, we have an unnamed woman who stands in the spotlight. Today we're contrasting a woman who thought Jesus is worth everything to a crowd who think Jesus is worth nothing. So let's take a look at Mark's painting, and our eye is first drawn to this woman. It really is quite a simple story, and the focus of the action is down there in verse 3. While Jesus was in Bethany, reclining at a table in the home of Simon the leper, a woman came with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume made of pure nard. She broke the jar and poured the perfume on his head. Now, you might not know what alabaster is or pure nard. I think it's made from some plant that they find in the Himalayas. But you don't really need to. Mark makes his point very clear. What we really need to know about this is that this is very expensive perfume. Or in verse 5 it says it could have been sold for more than a year's wages. I did a little research, and the nearest equivalent that I could find was a bottle of Chanel No. 5 retailing for $30,000. Here how it's described. Apparently, it has all the original notes of the original Chanel No. 5, but with a base underlined by a smooth touch of bourbon vanilla, which bursts forth at the heart of a floral bouquet to give a lasting yet powdery composition. Yours for the cheap price of $30,000. I'm sure we can imagine it would be a wonderful Christmas present, but imagine going round to your friend's house, bringing just such a bottle of perfume, and as they're munching away on their Christmas dinner, pouring it over the top of their head. You'd get a pretty strong reaction from that, wouldn't you? But that's what this woman does, and the question really is, well, why? Why does she do it? I imagine her standing on her own at home, and in a moment of quiet reflection, she decides what she's going to do with this family heirloom. This is no small gesture. Most families would have to live hand to mouth at that time, earning each day their daily bread. And so for them to have money set aside would be near on impossible. This priceless perfume has to be something that's been handed down from generation to generation, an investment to be spent only in time of desperate need. It would take clarity of mind to walk round to where Jesus was. It would take courage to defy the stares and the scowls of those eating with him. It would take conviction of purpose to pour out this gloop worth $1,000 an ounce until it's running down Jesus' beard and filling the room with its sweet scent. Why did she do it? Well, if this is the same incident that's reported in Luke 7, then we can see that the woman is deeply grieved at her sin and deeply grateful for Jesus' forgiveness. Jesus explains to Simon, those who have been forgiven little, love little, but those who've been forgiven much will love much. If it's the same incident reported in John 12, then this is Mary, the sister of Lazarus, who's received her brother back from the dead. There's gratitude mixed into this. Both John and Luke add that this woman doesn't just stop with the perfume, but she kisses Jesus' feet and wipes them with her tears and with her hair. It's an embarrassing, almost over-the-top display of emotion. But Mark brings out a slightly different emphasis. Verse 8, she did what she could. She poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare for my burial. Having been with Jesus for some time now, she realizes that Jesus is going to his death. And in contrast to Peter, who tried to stand in Jesus' way and oppose him, well, she does what she can. She prepares him for it. It's a remarkable gesture of faith to acknowledge that his death is inevitable and necessary. She had understood why Jesus had come. At Mark 10:45, the Son of Man, that's Jesus, didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. But not just a ransom for many, but a ransom for her. In verse 1, Mark deliberately sets this meal in the context of the Passover, a meal that remembered another ransom in Israel's history, how a lamb had to be killed instead of God's people dying so that they could go free. And that swap, Jesus' life for her, well, that puts her gift in context, doesn't it? Compared to Jesus' life, well, a bottle of perfume is a small thank you note, really. It is, in fact, in perfect proportion to what she has received. She is denying herself and taking up her cross and following him. And notice she does so. Her response is unrestrained, isn't it? It's unrestrained by what others think and undeterred by their comments. When those around her discourage her and rebuke her harshly, well, she carries on. I have to say, if this was me, I would have turned back at the first sign of discouragement, but she's not. Because she's not bothered about serving in the sight of others. She's bothered about serving Jesus, which means that she can continue, even when that isn't acknowledged, even when that isn't appreciated by those around her. But that's the challenge for us today. Not so much have we done what she's done, but have we seen what she's seen? Have we seen the all-surpassing value of Jesus' death, a death that opens up the possibility of a fresh start? What wouldn't we give at some points to go back and do things again? The possibility of forgiveness. Guilt is a heavy burden to carry. What wouldn't we do to take it off our shoulders? The possibility of change. Who doesn't want to be a better version of themselves? The possibility of grace, the possibility of security, the possibility of life, of being loved, of being adopted, of being given an ever-caring father. Have you seen what this woman has seen? If we have, then we'll respond as she has, not with gifts of expensive perfume. No, Jesus isn't here to do that anymore. But we'll respond. She did what she could, and we'll do what we can. There's real comfort there in that verse, isn't there? Jesus doesn't ask us to do what we can't. He doesn't ask us to save the world or change the world or save other people or to plunge ourselves into debt or to solve everyone's problems. He doesn't even ask her for this perfume. But the challenge is that he didn't have to. She simply responded to what she saw in Jesus. And if we do the same, then no doubt our faith will show in extravagant and costly ways as well. Perhaps in speaking about Jesus when it's costly to do so. In forgiving others when it's costly to do so. In caring for others when it's costly to do that. This woman paid it gladly, and what's more, she is commended for it. Verse 9, truly I tell you, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will be told in memory of her. That is an incredible honor, isn't it? That as the good news of Jesus' person and work goes out to the world, well, the story of her faith is going to go hand in hand alongside it. Jesus is not stingy in his praise of her. He's not stingy in his praise of us. In Hebrews 11, we can read about that great cloud of witness, people in the Old Testament who were faithful. If you read their stories, you actually think, well, how can they be commended? Some of them are the scum of the earth. And yet in Hebrews 11, they're commended for their faith as great trophies of grace and triumphs of faith. Isn't it touching here how Jesus defends her in verse 6? Leave her alone, said Jesus. Why are you bothering her? She has done a beautiful thing to me. She has done what is morally right, what is virtuous and good. But it's also a remarkable commendation in light of Jesus' impending death. Jesus is being prepared for his burial. A near equivalent would be if this woman had come in with a tape measure to measure Jesus up for his coffin, sort of wandering out to a van and bringing one in, and would Sir care to try this one on for size? Jesus is about to die. He knows his death is just about the corner, but he also knows his death is not the end. He foresees a time when he will rise again, and the good news will be preached throughout the world, as has happened. 2,000 years later, well, hundreds of empires have risen and fallen in that time. But news of this woman is still going out. As Jesus says, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. Which is excellent news when he says things like, your sins are forgiven. Come to me, all you who are weary, and I will give you rest. Well done, good and faithful servant. But the woman's valuation of Jesus is set in contrast to a host of other characters who value Jesus very little. Her brightness serves to show their darkness. See, it's important to notice that Judas and the others have had the exact same opportunities as this woman. They've spent time with Jesus. They've seen his miracles. They've heard the good news and heard some of the same warnings. Unlike the woman, actually, Judas has been with Jesus from the start and received his personal private tuition. But whereas out of her heart grows the fruit of worship, well, from their heart grows the thorns of scorn. Verse 4. Some of those present were saying indignantly to one another, "Why this waste of perfume? It could have been sold for more than a year's wages and the money given to the poor." And they rebuked her harshly. Theirs is an equally strong reaction. The language communicates them flaring their nostrils and steam coming out of their ears. They scold her severely. But isn't it an interesting reaction? People don't like things that show them up. The woman's gift raises questions for their own. Well, why haven't they poured out perfume upon him? Why aren't they kissing his feet? Her light exposes their darkness and they're trying to cover it up. Well, that money should have been given to the poor. As an excuse, it sounds quite virtue signally, doesn't it? Well, we're really concerned for these poor over here. And they might have a point. In 2009, Paris Hilton is reported to have spent £250,000 on a mansion for her dogs. Their kennel costs more than my house, which seems excessive, doesn't it? If not criminal, when you consider it in light of global poverty. How can she afford to spend that on her dogs when other people are starving? Now, Jesus isn't against giving to the poor, and he makes that very clear. Verse 7, "The poor you will always have with you, and you can help them any time you want, but you will not always have me." Our love for Jesus will often be expressed in care for the poor. The second great commandment is to love your neighbor as yourself. But the first is this, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. Jesus was the poorest man in the room. 2 Corinthians 8:9. "For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, for your sake he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich." John's account tells us even more of Judas's motives. Judas didn't say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put in there. Their concern for the poor is actually a mask to hide their poor valuation of Jesus. What they're saying implies that Jesus isn't worth it. Looking at her sacrifice, they say, "Well, what a waste. Why devote money to him?" And we can see that today as well, can't we? If you want to devote your life to fly fishing or Airfix model making, people will say, "Go ahead with our blessing." If you want to devote your life to your career, then people will respect you for it. If you want to devote your life to fell running, people will cheer you along from the finish line. But if you want to devote your life to Jesus, they'll sometimes call you mad. If you appear at all zealous in your love for him, they'll say, well, steady on there. But that's because they don't value Jesus. In fact, Judas shows how little he values Jesus with what he goes on to do next. In verse 10, Judas Iscariot, one of the 12 no less, went to the chief priests to betray Jesus to them. They were delighted to hear this and promised to give him money, so he watched for an opportunity to hand him over. Well, Matthew's gospel reports that they offered Judas 30 silver coins to betray Jesus. 30 silver coins was a couple of weeks' wages, which, when stacked next to what this woman has just poured on Jesus' head, a year's worth of savings, is quite a stark contrast, an insultingly small amount to betray a close friend. Whereas this woman is willing to give everything for Jesus, Judas is out to gain what he can from Jesus. He's a fair-weather follower who followed Jesus for the money he could make on the side. Like the other disciples, he thought that following Jesus was a career-advancing opportunity. When Jesus is crowned as king, they would be his trusted counselor. And that gets exposed when the going gets tough. Jesus is crossing lines of what is and isn't socially acceptable, and that's a price too high for Judas. He thinks he's found a better offer, and the chief priests are delighted. That's putting it mildly. Really, they rejoice at Judas being willing to betray his master. See, they also want to spend their money on Jesus. They think that Jesus is worth getting rid of and are willing to pay to do so, because they're concerned with what Jesus is going to cost them if they don't. At this point, Jerusalem was a powder keg of expectation. Everyone expected that the Messiah would arrive at one of these festivals, a festival like the Passover. That's why Mark says in verse 1 that the chief priests and the teachers of the law were scheming to arrest Jesus and kill him, but not during the festival, they said. Otherwise, the people may riot. If Jesus claims to be a king now, that poses a very real threat to their authority, and they will pay good money to get him off the stage. And we'll see that happening as we pick up in Mark chapter 14 at some point next year. But just as the woman's light exposes the darkness in their heart, so also this woman's light might also expose a little darkness in ours. After all, we can't read these verses without thinking, what a contrast. Why don't we worship Jesus as she does? Why are we cold when it comes to our love for him? Are we restrained by what others think? Why do we hold back when giving to him? Perhaps like the dinner guest, we have our well-worn excuses that money could have been given to the poor. I'm just too busy with work. Others are just like me. It doesn't really hurt anyone anyway. What we're really showing is the value that we put on Jesus. When I think about Judas, I'm concerned. All it cost to betray Jesus was 30 silver coins. What will it take for me to betray Jesus? What are my 30 silver coins? Everyone has their price. Might be a promotion at work, a popularity with the crowd, an easy and comfortable life. When we find what appears to be a better offer, will we betray him? Or have we already done so? Judas hands Jesus over. But as I say, he isn't the only one who deserts Jesus. By the end of the chapter, all his friends have fled him, and Peter, his closest friend, the one who's helping Mark to write this gospel account, is on the floor in tears, having denied Jesus 3 times. And if we're honest, I suspect we've all done that one way or another. And that's why we need to hear more of the plan to kill Jesus. Not Judas's plan to kill Jesus, not the chief priest's plan to kill Jesus, but God's plan to kill Jesus. Further on in Mark 14, in verse 21, Jesus says that the Son of Man, that's Jesus, the Son of Man will go just as it is written about him. But woe to that man who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born. Jesus is not weak. He's not stupid. He knows what Judas is about to do. But whilst Judas has been planning to kill Jesus for a few days, there is a far older plan at play, one that's been in place for millennia beforehand, one that's been written about for centuries in the Old Testament. Jesus deliberately comes to fulfill that plan. The Son of Man will go just as it is written about him. Throughout Mark's Gospel, Jesus has explained his death in light of passages from Isaiah, from Exodus, from Malachi, from Daniel. Even at his death, he'll quote from Psalm 22. Jesus is not blindsided by Judas's betrayal. He knows about it beforehand and brilliantly uses their plan to fulfill his own. A plan that he and his father has worked out from before the dawn of time, that he would come and take the punishment for our betrayal of him. Isn't that astonishing? Even as they're betraying him, he's planning a way to forgive them, which is what we need to hear as well. Jesus knows what's going on in each of our hearts. Mercifully, we don't. Sometimes he'll show us. He'll shine a spotlight on something and we'll go, yuck. How can anyone stand to be around me? How could God ever love me, warts and all? But Jesus already knew, and he willingly, deliberately, knowingly moves towards us in love, takes our sin on his shoulders and carries it to the cross. If that doesn't melt our hearts, I don't know what will. That's what this woman had seen, and that's what this woman adores Jesus for. So let's pray that we would do likewise.